Lot and his daughters.
Come, let us make our father drink wine. Genesis 19:32.
A blood-red moon finally rose after midnight, but a distant glow had been visible on the horizon a long time before, as if something afire was boiling up from the waters of the Dead Sea and spreading across the desert floor. Ever since that terrible morning when the earth shuddered and fire fell from the sky, the air was full of foul-smelling smoke and greasy ash by day, and the moon was stained red by night. Night and day, the youngest daughter of the man called Lot watched from the mouth of the mountain cave where they had sought shelter. Her sister refused to come out at all. She lingered in the back corner of the cavern, curled up alone, arms wrapped around her knees, rocking back and forth like a child in a bad temper. A few feet away, their father dozed in his own stony alcove, occasionally lifting himself up only to nibble something from the basket of food or to sip from the bottle of wine that they had thought to bring along, then slip into sleep again. The younger one was not afraid to venture out of the cave. She skittered up and down the rocky slope, sometimes daring to go as far as a stone's throw from the mouth of the cave, but never so far that she could not scamper back inside if danger threatened. She looked for something green that they might be able to eat, some small animal they might be able to hunt and kill, and, God willing, a spring that might replenish the skins of water that they had dragged up from the oasis town far below them. Above all, the younger one looked for the sign of another human being, whether man, woman, or child. She surveyed the jagged peak of the mountain, peered into the cracks of the black-gray rock on the lower slopes, shaded her eyes as she looked out over the empty desert floor, but she saw no one. "Your foolish little sister," the older one would insist whenever they spoke of her vigil outside the cave, "no one else is alive but us. And it's a good thing, too, because if anyone did find us, he would be like one of those brutes from back home. He would take you if and how he chooses, and then he would slay you." Then the older one would fall silent and begin to rock back and forth again. "But don't worry, little sister," she would always say. "No one is going to come, because no one else is alive but us." The older one was right, of course, about the kind of men who lived in Sodom. Back home, the younger one remembered the menfolk were brutal to any stranger who was unlucky enough to reach the city gates, and they were not much friendlier to their own neighbors. Toward women, they were like beasts. On the day before they fled to the mountains, Lot's family had learned that lesson once again. Their father returned to the house after nightfall with two hooded strangers. They had appeared at sunset at the gates to the city, where Lot bowed low to them and begged them to come home with him for a bath, an evening meal, and a bed for the night. At first, the strangers refused. "We will spend the night in the streets," they said. But Lot begged and pleaded with them, as was his custom when he encountered strangers who might bring him some good fortune. And finally, they agreed to follow him home. "Make welcome our guests," he commanded the women of the household, suddenly stern and imperious. "Wash their feet and make a meal for them." And then Lot whispered to his wife the same wishful words she had heard many times before from her husband. "Who knows when an ordinary stranger on the road might turn out to be an angel sent from heaven?" But the neighbors up and down the street were not so welcoming. Someone had noticed the two strangers following Lot back to his house, and a knot of rowdy young men gathered outside his door. Perhaps they'd been drinking, which was hardly surprising in Sodom, but wine alone did not explain their rough manners, which were common enough around town. Bored with the all-too-familiar pleasures readily available to them in Sodom, the townfolk were aroused by the very presence of strangers. Here was fresh meat. Soon the young men were joined by other curiosity seekers, young and old, and the crowd began to grow into a mob. "Hey, bring them out," someone shouted. "Bring out the strangers and let us have a look at them." "Yes, bring them out," another one called in a slurred voice.
so we can bugger them.
And the rest of the crowd took up the cry. Not only the rowdy young men who always seemed to range through the streets in search of excitement, but their fathers and their uncles, too. To Lot's younger daughter, who peered out from a window on the second floor while her sister cowered in the bed, it seemed as if every lout and his brother had gathered outside their house. Then she saw her father boldly step out of the house and close the door behind him. The crowd fell silent, as if in sheer amazement that Lot would actually leave the safety of his house and expose himself to their shouts, their fists, and worse.
"No, no, my friends," he said to them in a lilting voice, seeking to ingratiate himself with them by a fatherly scolding. "Do not be so wicked." "We want to bugger someone," a voice called from somewhere in the crowd, a voice thick with liquor and dangerous with the threat of sudden violence.
His words were greeted with laughter that sounded like the braying of donkeys.
"Give them to us!"
What her father said in reply, the younger daughter found hard to believe, even though she heard it plainly.
"Look, my friends, I have 2 daughters in my house," cried Lot, raising up both hands in a gesture of prayer, "both of them virgins."
A murmur rolled through the crowd, and the younger daughter shivered.
"I beg you, let me bring them out to you," Lot continued, "and you can do what you want with them."
"Yes, that's right," the younger daughter later told her incredulous sister. "Not once, but many times, that is exactly what our father said."
"Do whatever pleases you with my daughters, I beg you," Lot repeated pleadingly, "but do not touch the strangers who've sought shelter under my roof."
If the prospect of having their way with 2 young virgins was appealing to the men in the crowd, they gave no sign of it. Indeed, Lot's offer seemed to stir them to an even hotter rage than before.
"Out of our way," one of the men shouted at Lot. "You are a stranger, too, and now you set yourself up so high and mighty, you think you can tell us what to do? Out of our way, stranger!" "Or," another man took up, "we'll bugger you instead of them."
The crowd surged forward, and Lot's daughter feared that her father would be crushed and dragged away. But then she saw the front door fly open, and the light from the lamps inside fall on the faces of the crowd. The 2 strangers reached out of the doorway, clapped their hands on Lot's shoulders, and yanked him back inside the house so suddenly that he seemed to disappear. The crowd lingered outside the house, calling out and pounding on the door, but she could tell that their bloodlust had begun to ebb. A few men drifted away, laughing and singing bawdily, and the ones who remained were content to pass around flasks from which they occasionally took a long pull. Now and then Lot's daughter heard the sound of shouting and cursing, but the words were directed from one man in the crowd toward another. They seemed to have forgotten about the strangers and the young women inside the house. Now and then she heard a thunk, and then a cry of pain, "Oh!" as one of the men, blind drunk, bumped into a wall or a corner of the house. Before long, the stalwarts who lingered outside Lot's house were so drunk that they could not have found the front door if they tried, and even they began to stagger off in one direction or another. But there was still commotion in Lot's house, and his youngest daughter positioned herself at the top of the staircase so she could hear the words that her parents were whispering to one another in such urgent tones.
"Who are these strangers?" demanded Lot's wife, looking to the corner next to the hearth where the 2 figures, wrapped in their long cloaks, appeared to sleep. "And why have you brought them here to afflict us?"
"As I have told you, they are angels. They are messengers of the Lord who have come to bestow some gift upon us, which is what I have predicted many times, if you will recall," Lot said solemnly. "I could do no less than welcome them into our house."
"Angels, you say?" his wife laughed bitterly.
"Demons, more likely, or madmen."
"Quiet," Lot pleaded. "Did you not see them pluck me out of the hands of the crowd? Did you not see the light that shone when they opened the door to rescue me? Did you not see how the men in the street were struck blind? They must be angels. What I saw, Lot's wife hissed, is a man who would sacrifice the virtue of his own flesh and blood in order to protect a couple of perfect strangers.
Angels, that's what they are, he repeated. Listen to what they told me. Get out of Sodom, you and your family, because God has sent us to destroy this place. Take your wife, your children, and anyone who belongs to you, and flee. That is what they told me.
And, of course, you will do whatever they say, even though you never do what I say, your own wife and the mother of your daughters, his wife parried. If, in fact, you are not simply making up another tale.
I swear, good wife, this is what they told me. The evildoers in Sodom are so many and so vile in the eyes of the Lord that he sent them to destroy the whole place and everyone in it, right down to the last blade of grass.
Husband, you are mad, too. Never before had Lot's daughter seen her father so agitated, and she watched as he paced back and forth, kneading one hand in another, stopping occasionally to sway back and forth as if in prayer. Then, suddenly, he headed for the door.
"Where are you going, madman?" her mother called. "It's the middle of the night."
"To fetch our married daughters and their husbands," her father called, "so they, too, can flee."
Lot's youngest daughter slept where she sat, leaning against the wall at the top of the stairs. But she was awakened before dawn by the sound of her father clambering back into the house. Her mother, too, stirred, and rose to approach the old man, who was no less agitated than when he had left the house an hour or two before.
"What then?" the mother asked, a mocking tone in her voice.
"Where are our daughters and their husbands?"
"They refused to come," he said in a dull voice. "They laughed at me, as you do."
Lot sounded so dispirited that his wife took pity on him for a moment. "Sleep, then," she said in a softer tone, "and we'll talk more of this in the morning."
"Their husbands called me a fool," Lot complained. "Up, up and out of Sodom, because God is going to destroy this place," I told them.
And they said, "Every night there's plenty of food and drink, plenty of singing and dancing in the streets. Everyone in Sodom is happy but you, and only you say Sodom will be destroyed."
She beckoned him to the bed she'd made up near the stove, and he laid his head on the pillow next to her. Lot and his wife slept, and so did their daughters, as if they had forgotten about the strangers who waited out the long night somewhere in their house, neither seen nor heard. At dawn, an unfamiliar voice awakened them all.
"Arise," said one of the strangers hovering over Lot. "Arise, take your wife and your daughters, and flee."
By now, Lot's older daughter was awake, too, and the younger one followed her down the short staircase to the room where Lot and his wife now stood before the strangers.
"What is going on here?" the older daughter demanded. "What do these men want?"
The two strangers reached out and took each family member by the hand. Their touch was hot, and their fingertips seemed afire with fever. A strange light burned in their eyes. "The Lord will show his mercy to you, but only to you," one of the men said. "The rest will be destroyed, every man, woman, and child in Sodom, everything, right down to the last blade of grass." Lot cast a glance in his wife's direction as if to say, "I told you so." She caught his glance and scowled back.
"Come with us now," the other stranger said. "We will take you to safety before we begin our work."
Lot's wife started to speak, but the two strangers moved abruptly to the door and then into the street, where they disappeared from sight in the silver-gray fog that had settled over Sodom by night. Lot followed in haste, and suddenly he too was gone. Now Lot's wife seized the two young women by the hand and followed her husband through the doorway. As if in a dream, they all seemed to float down the road in the morning mist, past houses where the carousers still slept, until they found themselves on the outskirts of Sodom, well past the city gates, on the road leading out of town. Here the two strangers stopped and turned to face Lot and his family. Keep going until you reach the highest mountain, one of the strangers said, gesturing toward the black and gray peaks on the far horizon. If you stay here, you will be burned into ash along with the others. Flee for your life, the other one commanded, and do not look back.
Why can't we look? Demanded Lot's wife, emboldened by the fact that they were now safely out of Sodom.
Hellfire and brimstone will rain from the heavens, intoned one of the strangers in a solemn voice, and all will be destroyed. Right down to the last blade of grass? Lot's wife interrupted. Yes, that's right, the other stranger continued, glancing at Lot and then fixing a stern gaze on his wife. And you are not permitted to see it happen, or something terrible will happen to you too. Hasten to the mountain, the first one repeated, and do not look back.
The mountain, you say? Asked Lot.
The stranger sighed in exasperation.
Yes, the mountain.
But surely, Lot said, if your servant Lot has found grace in your eyes, and surely I am your very humble servant, and if you have stretched your mercy so far that you're willing to save the life of one miserable man, my life, you understand, well, then surely you can stretch your mercy just a bit further, can't you?
What? The stranger interrupted, now plainly out of sorts and anxious to get started on his work back in Sodom. What are you talking about?
Kind masters, merciful masters, Lot stammered. It's the mountain, which is far off and covered with snakes and wild beasts, I'm sure, and a hard climb even if we manage to get there at all. Surely it would be a foolish thing to spare my life here and now only to have some evil befall me on the way to the mountain and have me die anyway.
Perhaps you do not understand, the other stranger said, struggling to control his temper, speaking slowly and clearly as if to a child.
A terrible thing is going to happen to the cities of the plain and everything that lives there. From your ill-mannered neighbors right down to the last blade of grass under your feet, as your wife has already grasped, even if you haven't. And you can only save yourself by going to the mountain.
What is there about the word flee that you don't understand? The first one asked.
Look, said Lot, bargaining now rather than pleading. There's a small town not far away from here, just a watering hole with a few palm trees and some miserable hovels. Just a little place, not a big cesspool of corruption like Sodom. I'm sure the people there are much nicer than the Sodomites who were so rude to you last night. Why don't you let me go there? After all, it's a tiny place. Not even worthy of being called a town at all, really, don't you see? But it's so handy and close by. And if you could see it within yourselves to spare that little town, then my poor miserable family and I would find a decent place to lay our heads, and we won't have to go all the way to the wilderness and climb the mountain that you speak of. So we might actually survive all the terrible things that you're going to do, which is what you want, isn't it?
All right, we'll do it, said the first stranger. We'll spare the little town you speak of. But you've got to go, and you've got to go right now.
Because, interrupted the other one, we can't even start doing what we came to do until you're gone.
We'll go, Lot conceded at last. Believe me, we're as good as gone already.
The sun was high in a cloudless blue sky by the time Lot and his little band of refugees spotted the oasis and the cluster of low houses that made up the little town. And then, suddenly, the terrible thing began, just as the two strangers had said it would. From somewhere far behind them came a low rumble of thunder, a belching of foul-smelling smoke, and a shudder of the earth itself that seemed to travel under their feet, tossing them up and down like puppets on a string. Lot's older daughter began to cry.
"Father, what is happening back there?" she asked. "What's happening to our good sisters and their babies?"
Maybe they've changed their minds, the younger daughter suggested, and they're following behind us right now.
Yes, yes, said Lot's wife, no longer sounding so scornful of what the strangers had vowed to do. Maybe the little one is right. Maybe we should wait right here for them to catch up with us.
Don't be a fool, Lot commanded, though his quavering voice betrayed his fear. We do what the angels told us and flee.
Lot's wife laughed bitterly.
Angels, she said. You still call them angels, these strangers with the blood of your own children on their hands?
Then, as if to silence her, a sharp cracking sound was heard from far away, and a wave of heat rolled up from behind them and enveloped them. The air seemed to thicken and shimmer before their eyes. The stink of sulfur filled their nostrils, and new sounds reached their ears, as if the cries of men, women, and babies suffering and dying were carried on the hot winds across the plains all the way from Sodom. Now they began to walk faster, panting and gasping in the vile air, suddenly so heavy with greasy white ash. And they hastened toward the first house on the outskirts of the little town. They heard another rumble far behind them and broke into a trot, not stopping until they reached the shelter of the first house. Lot bent over, hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath. His older daughter simply folded up like a doll and rolled on the ground, weeping quietly. But his wife stood, upright and rigid.
Maybe the others are coming now, she said aloud. Maybe we can see them on the road. Mama, don't, cried the younger daughter, but it was too late.
Her mother turned and looked, shading her eyes with one hand, squinting against the terrible light that burned on the far horizon. Lot's wife stared into the distance. What she saw, the rest of them never knew. Her eyes widened, but she did not speak. Her mouth twisted into a horrible knot. And then, as Lot's younger daughter looked up at a face she barely recognized, the terrible expression began to harden. The hot ash that was drifting down from the sky like silent rain began to cover the crown of her head, the tip of her nose, her arms and shoulders. And then, falling more quickly now, the ash cooled, hardened, and crystallized until Lot's wife was encased in a shell of opalescent white rock that turned her into a statue of herself. Whether it was the flakes of ash falling on her lips or the tears falling from her eyes, Lot's youngest daughter suddenly tasted salt on her tongue. Father, she shouted, but Lot could barely hear her voice over the hot wind that blew around them from the direction of Sodom. Then, turning to follow his daughter's gaze, Lot beheld what had become of his wife. He nodded slowly, then sighed.
She should not have looked, the father said. You heard the angel tell her, did you not?
Oh, Mama, cried the oldest daughter.
Hurry, cried Lot, pulling ahead of his wife and daughters. The little town where they found refuge had been spared from the hellfire and brimstone, as the strangers promised. But the place was deserted. To Lot's relief, no corpses were to be seen in the tents and low houses that lined the road, but also no townspeople, no livestock, not even a stray dog. Perhaps the townspeople had been exterminated by the angels, or, more likely, they had fled before the sights and sounds coming from the direction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot and his daughters trudged along the road, hungry and weary, their eyes burning and their lungs straining for breath, until Lot stopped and held up one hand. Let us pause here, Lot said at the threshold of the largest house, and refresh ourselves. If the owners of the house had escaped, they left in a hurry. Lot and his daughters found warm food on the plates in the kitchen, clothing in the chests, a well-stocked pantry, and a storehouse behind the house full of wine and grain and oil in earthenware vessels. They sat down at the table and dined in silence on the food that had been left behind. The two young women ate and drank sparingly, but Lot poured himself generous portions of the wine from one of the jars that had been found in the storehouse. He then claimed a large bed that had belonged to the master of the house, wrapped himself up in the dusty bedding, and fell into a deep sleep, while his daughters searched out some blankets and made their beds on the floor. Neither daughter slept soundly. Nightfall came early,
if only because the day was turned into twilight by the bilious clouds that boiled up out of Sodom and drifted overhead. All the while they were afflicted by the stench on the wind that blew from the direction of Sodom, the greasy smoke and the settling ash that was carried along with it, and the occasional rumbles and shocks that could be felt before they were heard. If one of Lot's daughters succeeded in drifting off to sleep, she would awake with a start at a sound that seemed to come now from the street outside, now from the roof, now from the very next room. Yet if one of them arose and peered out, she found the courtyard of the house and the street beyond utterly empty. And when they found their father in the kitchen the next morning, already swigging a bottle of wine, they discovered that he too had been stirred by these ghostly sounds.
"I swear this place is haunted," he said. "We'll not stay here another night."
"But where will we go?" his older daughter asked mournfully. "Sodom is destroyed, and everyone with it, even our poor mother."
Lot considered for a moment, took another long pull on the bottle, and then nodded.
"The mountain," he announced in a voice that struck his daughters as almost cheerful.
No one spoke of it, but Lot's younger daughter thought to supply the little band of survivors with a few supplies from the house. When at last they trudged out of town, she pulled along a wooden cart loaded with skins full of water, sacks of flour, and a few sealed clay jars, some filled with wine, some with oil. Her sister carried a bundle of blankets and cloaks on her back. Lot led the way, wielding only a long wooden staff that he'd found by the threshold of the house. Once they cleared the last stand of date palms and joined the road out of town, they began to see the aftermath of what had happened on the day their mother was turned into a pillar of salt. Corpses of men, women, and children could be seen here and there along the roadside, and in great numbers at the crossroads. Their packs and carts were broken and overturned, their household goods scattered in the sand. Their animals had fled, and the hot wind was already turning their remains into mummies. At the crossroads, Lot and his daughters kept their eyes down to avoid even a glimpse in the direction of Sodom, and turned instead toward the low range of ash-gray mountains on the horizon. The highest one, studded with crags and peaks, seemed only a short distance off, but they would have to cross a vast expanse of cracked hardpan and sharp stones before they reached the place of refuge promised to them by the strangers. Lot's younger daughter soon showed herself to be adept at finding food and water and shelter, even in the forbidding reaches of the hill country. She scouted out a cave where they spread their bedding and stored their provisions. She caught small animals in a snare fashioned out of twigs and strips of cloth torn from her own clothing. She found a desert plant that was prickly on the outside, but sweet and wet on the inside. As she grew braver, she explored the rocky peaks above the cave, and she found a hidden canyon that offered a stand of date palms and a spring of water deep inside a grotto. It was then she realized that even if the rest of the world had been blasted into salt ash, they would not die after all. "We will be all right, sister," the younger one said one day. "We will have enough to eat and drink."
"Yes, but what kind of life will we have here?" the older one complained. "We are all alone in the world. Everyone else is dead. Do you know what that means?"
The little sister looked at her quizzically.
"It means that we will never see a man other than our own father for as long as we live," the older one said. "We will never marry. We will never bear children. Our father is already an old man and growing older fast, as you can see for yourself. When he dies, we will be alone in this miserable place until we grow old and die."
The little one considered her sister's dire prediction. True enough, they had seen no living human being since the morning they rushed out of Sodom. And she, too, had noticed that her father seemed older, grayer, and more feeble as each day passed.
"I wish Mama was here. Don't you?" she said at last.
"But she isn't," the older one said in a sharp voice that reminded the younger one of her mother.
and that means there's only one solution to the problem.
What do you mean, sister?
We will lie with our father, she announced grimly, and he will give us babies.
Lie with father?
Don't pretend to be so innocent. You heard what the women used to talk about when they were drawing water from the well? You know how babies are made.
You want to make a baby with our father? She squealed. What a horrible thought.
We will make babies so we will not be alone when he dies, and so there will be someone left here when we die. The older one seemed angry.
It's the only thing left for us to do.
If we were back home, the younger one said, we would have proper husbands to lie with us and give us babies, as our poor dead sisters did with their husbands. The older sister laughed out loud.
Have you already forgotten what the men in Sodom were like?
Anyway, they're all gone now, and the only man left is our father. The younger one thought for a moment and then nodded.
Tell me what I need to know, she said. Tell me what I need to do.
The older one had contrived to put aside a couple of jars of wine from the oasis town, and she kept them hidden even when Lot's supply ran out and he began to groan in despair over the lack of something to drink besides water. Now she fetched the wine from his hiding place, and she appeared at his alcove as the sun was setting and the shadows inside the cave were deepening. Soon, she knew, it would be so dark that neither of them would be able to see the other at all.
Look, father, she said cheerfully, look what I found.
What is it? I can't see a thing.
A jar full of wine, she announced, from the house back in that little town.
Where the devil did that come from? I knew I had another jar somewhere. Have you been hiding it from me, you ungrateful child?
Oh, no, how could you think such a thing of me, she said coquettishly. I found it among the rocks outside the cave. We must have dropped it on the way up the mountain.
Well, then, give it to me.
Here it is, father, she said. Drink your fill.
She hung back in the shadows while her father pulled the stopper and lifted the heavy jar to his lips. He drank greedily, but took care not to spill even a drop of the precious stuff. Then he pushed the stopper back into the mouth of the jar.
I'll save some for tomorrow, he announced virtuously. I'll make it last.
No, father, drink your fill. Actually, the truth is I found two jars, so you will still have a drink tomorrow.
Two jars you've hidden? Lot said.
He drank a long draught, belched loudly, and then drank again. Deprived of wine for so long, he seemed to feel the stuff boil up into his head as soon as it touched his lips. His eyes blurred and his head swam. To his amazement, his daughter seemed to disappear before his eyes, although he could not be sure because the cave itself seemed to tilt crazily and slip into a profound darkness as the sun went down. He took another long sip and allowed himself to doze. Lot's daughter, crouching a few feet away in the darkness, heard the rhythmic sound of his breathing. She sighed, then unfastened her robe and set herself to the task at hand. Her father was heavy and hard to handle, and she was panting with exertion as she struggled to position him. So drunk was her father that when she emerged from the cave some time later, he did not even stir. The younger daughter was waiting at the mouth of the cave, watching the reflection of the full moon on the far distant waters of the Dead Sea, when the older one joined her at last. She half expected her older sister to look somehow disfigured, somehow tainted, but the moonlight did not reveal any obvious scars. She noticed only that her sister seemed pale and fatigued and vaguely disheveled.
"What happened?" the younger one asked with urgent curiosity. "What did he say?"
He didn't say anything, thank God, the older one said grimly. He was too drunk to even notice.
He did not even know
I was there, the older sister interrupted. as if afraid to hear spoken aloud what had happened back in the cave. And he didn't even know when I left. She paused. I did what I had to do, and when it was done, I left him fast asleep like a beast. Well, the younger one ventured, that makes it all the easier, doesn't it? Yes, it does, the older one said. And tomorrow, little sister, it's your turn. The younger one was silent. But there are some things you'll have to know, the older sister began. Some things you'll have to do. You've already told me how to make a baby. Well, as it turns out, there's more you need to know, she said. At least when a man is dead drunk on the floor, there's more. What do you mean, sister? Lot's older and now wiser daughter pulled the younger one to her side and began to explain. If Lot remembered anything of what happened on those two nights on the mountain, he said nothing of it. Even when the bellies of his daughters began to swell, even when it was quite obvious that they had lain with someone long after the last man in Sodom had been slain, Lot was silent. When Lot's daughters gave birth, the older one called her son Moab, which means from father, and the younger one called her son Ben-Ami, which means son of my kin. But Lot gave no sign that he understood the message that his daughters intended to send him.
Apologists of three religions have tried to explain away the scandalous conduct of Lot and his daughters ever since their tale was first recorded in the book of Genesis. And yet, curiously enough, Lot's willingness to cast his virgin daughters to a lusty mob and his own incestuous, if unconscious, couplings with his daughters after their flight into the mountains are not regarded by clergy and commentators as his worst offenses as a father, a husband, and a man. Lot is the hapless nephew of Abraham, the patriarch and paradigm of the man of faith, on whom God bestows a rich and enduring blessing. I will make of thee a great nation, God tells Abraham. Lot, by contrast, is something of a schlemiel who tags along after Abraham and relies on his kindly uncle to get him out of trouble. Astoundingly, scholars and sages over the centuries have tended to overlook the most obvious and abhorrent conduct of Lot, and they spend much breath and ink in debating whether, for example, Lot ought to be condemned because he procrastinates in leaving Sodom, or because he haggles with the angels over the place of refuge. When it comes to the most grotesque and repulsive of Lot's conduct, his willingness to cast his daughters to the mob, the apologists offer thin excuses. The surprising offer of his daughters must not be judged simply by our Western ideas, urged Gerhard von Rad, a distinguished commentator on Genesis. That Lot intends under no circumstances to violate his hospitality, that his guests were for him more untouchable than his own daughters, must have gripped the ancient reader. What grips the modern reader, by contrast, is Lot's readiness to allow the claims of courtesy to transcend moral obligations of fatherhood, as one Bible scholar rather delicately puts it. And it is simply not enough to shrug and say that we cannot understand how men and women who lived a few thousand years ago must have felt about their children. The attitude of the biblical author toward Lot is not spoken out loud, but it is hard to miss in an open-eyed reading of the Bible. Lot is depicted as neither a coward nor a champion. Rather, he is shown to be a clown, a tragic buffoon. When it comes to the forbidden sexual union of father and daughters, however, the biblical storyteller is straight-faced and even solemn. Lot's daughters, like his wife, are unnamed, a considerable slight in a book whose authors are fairly obsessed with genealogies and the giving and meaning of names, but they show themselves to be bold, intrepid, and resourceful young women who are willing to defy the taboo against incest and the apparent will of God in order to restore life to the blasted and empty place that they behold from their mountain refuge. Significantly, the elaborate seduction of their father is described without a single disapproving word from the biblical author. Lot's daughters are spared the harsh judgment that is visited upon so many other women in the Bible. The Bible tells us, by the way, that the sons of Lot's daughters are the eponymous patriarchs of two nations, Ammon and Moab, that will become the bitter enemies of the Israelites, Located to the east of Canaan, in what is now the modern nation of Jordan, Ammon and Moab are specifically spared from conquest when God sends the Israelites into the promised land under a banner of war. Be not at enmity with them, God says, because I have given Moab and Ammon unto the children of Lot for a possession. The Bible reserves a crucial role for these cave-born bastards in spite of their incestuous origins and the future clashes between their descendants and the Israelites. A Moabite woman named Ruth is destined to marry an Israelite man, and their bloodline will lead directly to the birth of David, the greatest of the kings of Israel. An Ammonite woman named Naamah will be counted among King Solomon's 1,000 wives and concubines, and fatefully it is Naamah who will give birth to Solomon's successor to the throne of Israel. And it is from the house of David and Solomon that the Messiah will come, in both the Jewish and Christian traditions. So, the mountain cave in which Lot and his daughters seek refuge turns out to be the womb of history, and their drunken couplings amount to a sanctified union that will bestow upon the world what the Bible regards as its ultimate savior. Neither the taboo against incest nor the fear of divine retribution are sufficient to discourage these two audacious young women from doing what needs to be done to preserve their father's seed.